The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day. Gotta let it go. So
welcome back to Open the Voice Gate Rewind and Rewatch, episode 29, covering Open the Golden Gate from the Westin Los Angeles Airport Hotel in Los Angeles, California, on January 27th, 2012. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling feed or on the dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed on all podcast platforms and applications. You can find us on Twitter at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to the red circle. You hit the red button, and you can do a one-time or reoccurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we'd certainly appreciate it, and thanks to all previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Iron Mike Spears, joined as always by my co-host, Case Lowe. And Case, after, it seems like, 4 months, welcome to 2012, my friend. We're here.
This is obviously a huge year in society between Kony 2012 and the end of the Mayan calendar. It certainly seems like 2012 was a better time to be alive than our current 2020 incarnation. We had been recording episodes of the 2011 Dragon Gate USA run since mid-June, and so it is very nice to turn over the calendar and to have what really feels like a fresh coat of paint in this promotion. On this show, but especially going forward, things will change. We'll find out if it's for better or worse, but ultimately things are going to change. And it's nice to talk to you, Mike.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you too. And watching this show, I was like, oh wow, we actually have a lot of interesting stuff to talk about. Seeing that we went from the end of the year in 2011, closed out DGUSA's run, oddly enough, both in the arena and BB King's Blues Bar and Grill. We start off the year on the West Coast. It's the first ever like true West Coast show. 2 months later, we spent part of our wrap up last week getting into the end of 2011 and Dragon Gate. And Dragon Gate USA, but Case, big things were afoot to end out 2011 and 2012, and we have a lot to talk about before we get into this really fun Golden Gate show. So take it away with the timeline.
Well, Mike, I think to celebrate the glorious year that was 2011, we have to go to the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Awards. Are you okay starting there?
Yeah, let's start there. I had the date written down in my notes on when the awards were.
January 26, 2012.
All right, January 26, 2012. Interesting year of awards, and this is really something that... What were your thoughts just off the top looking at the awards?
I had no major issues with them. I actually think this was a year where the voters got it right, and I think for all of these categories, I'll highlight the top three for each category that we'll discuss, and then I'll highlight anything that pertains to Dragon Gate or the Dragon Gate USA universe in the top 10. But one of the things that stood out to me here is I think the Western idea is that New Japan Pro Wrestling, which we'll be talking a lot more about as we get into 2012, that New Japan really took off in the West in October of 2012 with their first Ustream show, King of Pro Wrestling, with the five-star Hiroshi Tanahashi versus Minoru Suzuki match. But as you'll see in the 2011 Wrestling Observer Newsletter Awards, Hiroshi Tanahashi and New Japan dominate, and it is a very good year for them, more so than it is for Dragon Gate. And I think 2011 is typically looked at as a year where a lot of Western fans had their eyes on Dragon Gate. Junction 3 versus Blood Warriors brought in a lot of Western attention. But these awards kind of say differently. It kind of says that New Japan was the top dog dating back to 2011.
And you know, it's something that if we chart out the 2010s, at least like Western consciousness, the intersection point probably would be somewhere between Wrestle Kingdom 6 and the first Ustream show on at least what I would consider Western popularity. Like, we talked about the first ever New Japan shows in the United States when they crowned their first Intercontinental Champion. And that kind of was the start of their futures drastically changing. It'll drastically change a lot more even through the calendar year of 2012. But I like look at the awards and I look at like the keynote awards and who appears where, and like if anything, this was a time that I know he's already in the Hall of Fame, but if there's something that like you want to stake a claim on who the most important person has been to New Japan Pro Wrestling, especially the person that, and I think he gets the credit for, which is that he's the person that went through those lean last Inoki years into the Yuke's years and then Bushiroad in a lot of ways, like they finally crystallized it, is this is kind of in a lot of ways what Hiroshi Tanahashi did in 2011, 2010, 2012 is like he was the lead blocker. He was the guy that took the company on his back when it was in its darkest place and was able to keep it alive until Bushiroad really was able to stabilize things. And these 2011 awards really kind of celebrate that. And I think that was a good move. This is not a set of awards really that I feel like that, like you said, you feel like they got them right. You know, I don't have a lot of complaints looking at these awards, and that's something that even for like WWE and TNA people, I usually would have some complaints, but I feel like that there's some categories I massively disagree with, but I see people's logic here. And that's not always the case, especially in recent years.
So when we talk about Flair Thaz Wrestler of the Year in 2011, third place was John Cena. Second place was CM Punk. And first place was Hiroshi Tanahashi. Masaaki Mochizuki finished 4th, Davey Richards finished 10th. Tanahashi over CM Punk is a shocker to me.
It's a shocker to me, especially given like CM Punk's 2011, but I feel like the farther we get away from 2011, the more I'm like, you know what? The voters are right about Hiroshi Tanahashi in 2011, even though CM Punk probably had one of the most notable years, at least for an American wrestler and an American promotion, at least until like Chris Jericho last year in AEW, maybe. So it makes sense.
And then from there, we go to most outstanding wrestler. This was taken home by the prodigal son, Davey Richards. Hiroshi Tanahashi, 2nd. Daniel Bryan, 3rd. Akira Tozawa, 7th. So between Tozawa's work in PWG at the start of the year, Dragon Gate USA throughout the year, and Dragon Gate proper in Japan in the back half of the year, Tozawa secures a 7th place finish with 19 first place votes. Davey Richards, 201 first place votes. He nudged out Tanahashi for that top spot. A great year for both men.
And the interesting thing about it is Akira Tozawa has the second least amount of first place votes on here, but he edges out like this tier of wrestlers. That's him, Averno, Eddie Edwards, and Dolph Ziggler. He has less first place votes for everyone in that that tier other than Dolph Ziggler. So what that tells me is a lot of people like were picking up these DVDs and the PWG DVDs and watching Dragon Gate USA, maybe we're catching Infinity, and we're like, all right, this guy might not be our number one or number two, but he appeared on a whole lot of ballots.
Yeah, if I had to construct some sort of 2011 ballot just from what we watched in this promotion and what I was rewatching from Dragon Gate to Japan with the context of everything else that I've seen from 2011, which is most stuff, it would be some sort of combination of Mochizuki, Tozawa, and Pac for my most outstanding. I really think those three had a particularly great year, and all of those guys play into our feud of the year when we move forward. John Cena versus CM Punk, I would say the rightful winner there. Randy Orton and Christian finished second place. Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards over the Ring of Honor world title that finished third. And fourth place, Mike, Blood Warriors versus Junction 3.
And with Junction 3 and Blood Warriors, second most first place votes. So what that's telling me is the people that watch Dragon Gate thought much more highly of this feud than a lot of people who didn't. And, you know, for like how important CM Punk was, at least for like that one calendar year, that again, I think the further we get away from it, the more it kind of diminishes, really shows you like how strong the stuff is in Dragon Gate and Dragon Gate USA in 2011. The fact that this entire like year long feud showed up ahead of a bunch of MMA feuds, some stuff that's happening in All Japan and some stuff. Nothing on New Japan made the list, which is interesting to me.
That is interesting, especially given the domination of Tanahashi. And then you look at Tag Team of the Year. First place is Bad Intentions, Giant Bernard and Carl Anderson. The Briscoe Brothers are second, and Strong BJ of Sekimoto and Okabayashi are third. Fifth place is the Young Bucks, who we'll be talking about a lot on this show. Seventh place is the Spike Mohicans of Shima and Ricochet. And there are honorable mentions. Look at these four honorable mentions. It's the All Night Express, who had a great 2011. It's Future Shock of Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly. It's Pac and Masato Yoshino. And it is Kevin Steen and Akira Tozawa. 2011 was a terrific year for tag teams.
Yeah, and like, just getting in like the overall rankings, you have the Briscoes, you have Strong BJ, you have Bad Intentions, which I think this was the last calendar year for Bad Intentions, because I think that soon, I forget his real name, but...
Bernard leaves to become Albert, right. Albert something. He becomes Lord Tenzai pretty early into 2012.
Yeah. So this is like last year of that, but I'm like looking at the rest of this, like you have Beer Money on this list, you have Apollo Go-Go, you have... Manabu Soya and Seiya Sonata, which was a big tag team for All Japan, and then you even have like the Airbroom tag team that, if it wasn't for the fact that you know drug testing protocols, like they ended up there as well. This is arguably like the tag teams is usually what I find like to be the most interesting category. Would this be maybe like the most stacked tag team category, given like how recently a lot of people are like, I don't know what tag teams to pick? With 2011, you have like 15 tag teams here that I would argue are thriving, even though I'm not big All Night Express fan. Like, there's a lot of great tag teams in 2011. Do personally, I would probably put Spike Mohicans, like the reason why Bad Intentions won is because they basically had like belt capper gimmicks that year. They went into, didn't they also win the GHC heavyweight tag this year as well? Like, they were winning a lot of tag team belts, but so, the Bucks being fifth considering the year they had in 2011 is something. But I think Spike Mohican's kind of got a little bit of the short shaft here.
The only other year I think of the past decade that would compare to it is 2015, and I'll quickly run down that top 10 just to give you an idea of what was going on there. It's the Young Bucks, Red Dragon, New Day, Strong BJ, Naruki Doi and Yamato, Jason Jordan and Chad Gable, Tyson Kidd and Cesaro, Michael Bennett and Matt Taven, Matt Sydal and Ricochet, Trent Beretta and Rocky Romero, and then an honorable mention list that includes the Killer Elite Squad, Jack Evans and Angelico, Doc Gallows and Carl Anderson, the Briscoes, and the American Wolves. So 2015 was stacked, and there's an argument to be made that maybe even an Amigo tag, you know, Yoshino and Sashi Hokoboy should have been included in that list as well. A Jimmy's team, maybe. But you look at that top five of Bucks, Red Dragon, New Day, and I don't know what the New Day did that year, but they were good enough for third and 167 first place votes. Strong BJ and Naruki Doi and Yamada, that is a pretty solid list.
Yeah, I think I would maybe take that 2015 list over 2011, but it's neck and neck, really. It's personal preference, I feel like.
Most improved is an interesting category to look at. The winner was Dolph Ziggler, who ran away with this, 224 first place votes. Mark Henry was second. I think this was 20 years into Mark Henry's career. Congratulations on a most improved there. Third place was Ricochet. To me, this was a no-doubter that Ricochet should have won this award. And then honorable mentions, there's Dragon Gate USA guys all over the place, with Akira Tozawa, Johnny Gargano, Sami Callihan, and Chuck Taylor in the honorable mention list. Mike, I've talked about it for years now. I correlate all of Ricochet's success directly to his 2011 and working with Pac on pretty much every show for an entire year.
Yeah, and I would say that this is probably the major category where the voters had the most egg on their face in retrospect. Because you look at, like, Dolph Ziggler, like, I feel like he's won Most Improved, like, five times.
It's either Most Improved or Most Underrated. It's like him and Cesaro in that Most Underrated category is always going to be a prominent feature.
And I feel like Mark Henry also got, like, 2006 was another time that that there was a big internet outcry for Mark Henry improving as a wrestler. The big thing that gets me here, and you know who I'm going to say this about, Kez, is Akira Tozawa wasn't that he was improved, it just was that he was given an opportunity and was told, hey, just go be yourself. So it's like the most misleading 11th place vote when really it just was, he was always good. He even in like 2008, he was always good. It just was the fact that he didn't have people yelling at him, for lack of a better words.
Best technical wrestler, Daniel Bryan, as always, won this award. Second place was Davey Richards. Third place was Prince Devitt, who was all over these ballots. He had a very strong 2011. No Drangate guys in contention there as we move to Best Brawler, in which we saw Kevin Steen win things pretty easily over Togi Makabe and the Briscoe brothers, who finished second and third, respectively. Sami Callihan, with his work in CZW, Evolve, and Drangate USA, he was able to notch a seventh place finish in these awards, with Brody Lee and Dean Ambrose finishing and the honorable mentions.
You know, no, I think that all lines up, especially, I think it's crazy for people who get into wrestling now, looking back this, like, Togi Makabe has been, like, a solid brawler for a long time. Now he just doesn't care because he makes his money doing advertising. But for a while, like, he was, like this really, like, frightful brawler. Like, there's a reason why he came out to Immigrant Song and had the chain. Like, it fit him very well. So, you know, this is actually, like, I think that this category might be the one where I think they were probably most on, other than everyone just, no one recognized how great Brody Lee was in 2011.
No, that's just something sickening.
I feel like we've come to terms with, right?
Absolutely. Well, luckily, when we look at these awards, I think the voters' heads were in the right place in 2011 for Best Flying Wrestler. Third place, Pac. Second place, Kota Ibushi. First place, Ricochet. I have no issue with this at all.
No. And I look at the rest of the top 10. No issue with the top 10. Rey Mysterio, 8th, seems a little bit like this. Devitt is 5, when most of his flying has been topes, you know? So, like, that's, like, the only things that's quibbling. But top 3, I mean, that's dead on. Like, no argument there.
Yeah, no, I think those are three guys that, you know, as the decade progresses, and I think as this decade progresses, we'll see a huge influence of what they did coming into fruition with a new generation of talent. Most underrated, there were no Drangate guys in the running there. Promotion of the year is interesting, though. UFC took home the top spot, New Japan Pro Wrestling in second, and Dragon Gate in third. Chikara, PWG, and Ring of Honor all in the top 10 as well.
So, last year, it was Ultimate Fighting Championship, then Dragon Gate. 2011, again, we were talking about how kind of the taste shift as New Japan, for like the first time in a long time, ends up number 2. And they would not be. Dragon Gate, I did not think, ever got ahead of New Japan since, at least in Western fans.
No, because New Japan ran away with everything. And I think even in a year like 2015, where Dragon Gate was better than New Japan, they just did not get the voter credit that they needed. The last category that we'll talk about, we'll just do the major A categories, B categories. I know Ricochet won Best Maneuver for his double moonsault. They did pretty well in the single vote categories, but we'll just focus on the big ones here. Worked match of the year. Mike, there is no Dragon Gate representation, and you think about all the great matches we watched, but apparently they weren't good enough, like John Cena versus CM Punk from Money in the Bank, Eddie Edwards versus Davey Richards from Best of the World, and Undertaker versus Triple H from WrestleMania. I believe that was 27 in Atlanta. So we comprised our own list of the top 10 Dragon System matches of 2011, featuring Dragon Gate, Dragon Gate USA, and on my ballot, Dragon Gate UK. Mike, would you like to do the honors of reading your top 10?
So mine's only DGUSA.
Ooh, okay. Well, no, I did a full ballot here of Dragon System.
I want to hear you point out your other Dragon System matches, then I'll get into my DGUSA ones afterwards.
Yeah, well, okay, I'll read my top 10 and then you can go from there. How about that?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so match of the year for me, 5-star match, Pac and Dragon Kid versus Shima and Ricochet at Kobe World 2011. It's one of the best matches in Dragon Gate System history. It's a five-star match, as is my second-place match from Dragon Gate UK, Shingo versus Osumu 3, October 22nd, 2011. One day this footage will become readily available. We will all bask in the glory that was this match. But for now, it is my hidden little secret, as I am one of the few people that bought this show on demand on WWN Live when they were, you know, selling their library. What a crazy thought that was. Third place, Masaki Mochizuki versus BB Hulk from Kobe World 2011. Fourth place, a match we have talked about so much recently, Naruki Doi KZ and Naoki Tanizaki versus Gamma, Punch Tamanaga, and Sachi Hoko Boy from November 19th. We move to Dragon Gate USA for fifth place, Shima and Ricochet versus Pac and Yoshino from Way of the Ronin 2011. Back to Japan for sixth place with Masaki Mochizuki versus Akira Tozawa. Seventh place, United Philly, one of the best shows we've watched up to this point, Naruki Doi and Ricochet versus Pac and Yoshino. You'll see a trend here of Pac in a lot of tag matches. Eighth place, right before Blood Warriors versus Junction 3 really took off, Masaki Mochizuki versus Yamato from Dead or Alive. Ninth place, Masaki Mochizuki versus Yasushi Kanda from June 19th. And 10th place, I think in any top 10 match of the year list, your 10th place needs to be a vanity pick of a match that you really like. And for me, that was Pac, Rich Swann, and AR Fox versus Shima, Ricochet, and Akira Tozawa from Indianapolis chasing the dragon September 9th.
This will frustrate you. That was my last cut.
Oh,
that would have been
my
10th.
That is storytelling as it should be done. It deserved a spot on your list.
Captain's Fall matches rule if you do them right. Like, might be my favorite thing that is not used a lot. Stardom, as of the time of recording, recently did one, and they didn't really do it right, but it was still, like, a decent match. But, God, I love a solid Captain's Fall match. So, yeah, I it's interesting, like, looking at your list, because clearly, if you want to take the Dragon System at whole, the MVP was Masaki Mochizuki in 2011. I think that's
Without question.
A controversial statement. I would say, though, and my list is solely of DGUSA, I don't have any big disagreements on your inclusions from Dragon Gate proper there, but here's my top 11, or my top 10 rather. So our one and two matches are the exact same. Spike Mohicans versus Pac and Yoshino from 9/11. I went 4.5 on that, and then Doi and Ricochet versus Pac and Yoshino from United Philly, 4.5 on that. Then it's Pac versus Ricochet from 11/13, so the final show of the year they had. Then Yoshino and Pac versus Yamato and Tozawa from June. That was after the big split, and they still were all doing this right before Tozawa, you know, right before that all happened, kicked off there. Then match five was Yoshino and Pac versus Shima and Doi from Mania Weekend. I went 4.5 there. Six, this might be my one vanity pick because I know how much higher I was on this than you. Hulk and Akira versus Chuck Taylor and Rich Swann from Freedom Fight 2011 at 4.5.
A match that Yamato, I loved, mind you. A match that I loved, just not as much as you.
Yeah. I mean, it is such a cool match, and it's something that I was really glad we got a chance to talk about last week. Seventh, Yamato versus Pac from, it's the part of the Championship Challenge weekend that they had. And then Naruki Doi versus Sami Callihan from 9/9 from Low Territory.
Wow.
And then I love that match.
Yeah, that's right, you did.
I love Territory Naruki Doi, as then I talk about from 9/11/11, Naruki Doi versus Johnny Gargano. Another one on there. And then my 10th ranked ass, I guess this is kind of a vanity pick for me. It is from Mania Weekend, is the Brave Gate match between Pac and Akira Tozawa.
Mike, I think that's an incredibly solid top 10. Your match 10 gets a proper rematch on Open the Golden Gate, and if it is okay with you, I think we are ready to put 2011 in the rear view and move ahead to the build of Open the Golden Gate, and that build is going to start with a promotion-shifting announcement on November 25th from the Dragon Gate USA Newswire when Gabe Sapolsky writes, Dragon Gate USA and Evolve have unified. Here's what this means, and then Gabe goes into about 5 bullet points that I think could have been condensed into one, essentially saying that Dragon Gate USA and Evolve now exist in the same universe. They're separate promotions, but the storylines carry over. Evolve records will matter in Evolve, and they will have influence in the Dragon Gate USA booking, but the records will not carry over. And Gabe alludes to the possibility of an Evolve title in 2012, but that does not happen for another year. So, Mike, we are now fully under the WWN Live umbrella as we would come to know it.
Yeah, yeah. And just, like, taking a step back, I think that this was something that, as we get into 2012 and we'll get more and more into it, this lets Gabe only have to, like, have the DG office people or Dragon Gate Japan people over only two shows versus three. And I think that at least I was starting to feel the fatigue of three of Triple Shot Week, and so I could tell that the wrestlers themselves did as well. So makes sense, and then especially if you have your championship belt on Johnny Gargano, you could still – you spent all that time building him up. He should be able to take over the Evolve brand until they have an Evolve championship. So it lines up. It's something that, given their business and given how the landscape drastically changed, I feel like it matches up. Like, it makes sense that this would happen. It is something, though, that – I will say that a lot of interest kind of dipped the more and more that Evolve became featured. So it was not without its risk.
Well, we have two notes here that pertain directly to Evolve. On December 5th, it was announced that UHA Nation and John Davis had both agreed to Dragon Gate USA contracts. Well-deserved from both of them, and they will hopefully have a big 2012. I'm not entirely sure what is in store for them. And then we get the confirmation on December 25th, that Evolve 10, January 14th from the ECW Arena, will be the final show in that arena. Gabe notes that the walls will be knocked down, including the bathroom area and the Eagle's Nest and all of the interior walls. The building will be completely remodeled. So Gabe is planning for a night of extreme surprises, headlined by Johnny Gargano versus Ricochet for the Open the Freedom Gate title. Mike, we've been joking about this show since show one, it feels like. I'm ready to run down the results of Evolve 10, a tribute to the arena, and then you have the floor to wax poetically about this show. Are you good with that?
Yeah, let's do it. The one thing I'll note, because of there's other stuff we want to get into, there's a lot of solid coverage done by both Dave, Brian, and other people about what was supposed to be the end of the era of the ECW arena. Of course, didn't end up being the end of the arena. I think funding fell through for them because the ideas they had for the arena were insane, what they were going to try to make it into. A 3,000-seat concert hall. Legitimately, that's what the owners did. And I think they changed ownerships after that. So we saw how well that went for them, Case.
Yeah, no, that is a disaster. Much like this show, Evolve 10, a tribute to the arena, January 14th, 2012. The show opens with low-key legitimately knocking out Atu, Larry Dallas's monster, in 2 minutes. We saw Cheech defeat Cloudy, the scene of Caleb Conley and Scott Reed. They defeated the Beaver Boys of Alex Reynolds and John Silver. Jigsaw defeated AR Fox. UHA Nation destroyed Pinky Sanchez. Ronin of Chuck Taylor and Rich Swann, they defeated the Super Smash Brothers in what I'm sure was an excellent match. John Davis defeated Kyle Matthews. Bobby Fish defeated Sammy Callahan. The Open the Freedom Gate title match, Mike, this match went 24 minutes and 21 seconds. Johnny Gargano made his first successful defense of the belt over Ricochet. And then the final match in the history of the ECW arena as we knew it then, Sabu defeated Justin Credible.
So, Taylor and Swan versus Super Smash Brothers was a very solid match. Probably the best match on the show. And the reason why I say that is, so you can watch this low-key versus Atu match. I think it's pretty much everywhere. It's long enough to be embedded in a Twitter clip. He basically bum rushes him, hits a capo kick, knocks the guy out. They stumble around for 20 seconds, and then he does the Warrior's Way and wins.
I don't condone it, but it is one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
Yeah. We're in the 2012. We're going to be talking about Loki for a couple of weeks.
I'm so pumped,
a month, guys.
I'm so pumped.
It is. There's something that's coming towards the end of the show that Case does not know about that I'm going to be talking about Loki with this that I'm stoked about. And then, yeah, I mean, Beaver Boys getting like this is when they were first starting to kind of do things. Don't remember much of Bobby Fish and Evolve. I knew it happened. This was also a drastically different Bobby Fish than before. Then we kind of need to get into why this Gargano and Ricochet match is so notable. I don't want to say it's notorious, but it was a very auspicious beginning to Johnny Gargano's Freedom Gate title reign.
I'm sure you have more information than I do, but I know Gargano was badly hurt the weekend before, tried to push through, and then minutes into this match, re-injured himself and aggravated that injury. And then on top of that, they ended up going longer than they were supposed to. So it's this hyped Gargano versus Ricochet match, and it was long anyways, but then you factor in Gargano moving in half speed in such a big moment that it just never lived up to the expectations. And I would say, for at least the people involved in the US indie scene, this is kind of an infamous match. This is a notorious, like, oh god, remember that? It was a complete and utter disaster.
Yeah. I would say that, with the exception of maybe that Hulk versus Susumu Yokosuka Freedom Gate match that was in Japan that was not very good at all, this is probably the worst championship match they've had, I would say. And I don't think that's being hyperbolic.
Ooh,
at all.
That will be an interesting thing to go back to at the end of this project.
Because, like, at this moment, I think it's the worst one they had as a to calendar date. I'll say that.
I would agree with that.
And like, the thing is like, so Gargano had a spine injury or something that, like, he, as you said, like, he aggravated beforehand. He talks about it, it's pretty open. Like, everyone, like, talks about it because it's that notorious of a match. His back seizes up partway, like, 2 minutes into the match, and he talks about for the next, like, half hour, he couldn't feel his limbs, and he still tried to have a match, and collapsed backstage, had to be taken to the hospital, and had to be wheelchaired onto and off of plane flights for that. And it just was, like, it's one of those things that, given those guys and given the guy's age, I mean, Ricochet's 23 at this point. Like, he's still practically, for all intents and purposes, a baby. And he's just someone, and Johnny Gargano is someone that, like, they did such a great job of how, like, they ended 2011 and how I choose to believe that they ended the show with him. And it just is one of those things that you just, like, look at and you're like, oh god, this was, like, a disaster. And it's probably, like, something that's, like, a feather in both Gabe and Gargano's hat that they were able to kind of reclaim this, like, title reign by, I don't know, at least by the title reign, it came back around. But this was definitely starting off on the wrong foot.
Yeah, it was just one of those seemingly classic Dragon Gate USA Evolve momentum killers where all of this hype would be built up. They finally had some portion of the community on their side, and then this happened. And I specifically remember the Evolve show years later. I think it was SummerSlam weekend 2016, where, you know, oh my god, Evolve's the hottest ticket in town, and Daniel Bryan and Cesaro are at this show, and then they have a Timothy Thatcher-Drew Gulak title match that is just dreadful, and then they try to do essentially an ECW six-man main event, and it bombed horribly, and oh, there goes Evolve again. Like, it just seemed like whenever this promotion, whatever branch, either the purple of Evolve or the red of Dragon Gate USA, whatever the ball would get rolling, it would immediately get stolen from them, and essentially life would windmill dunk in their faces.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, this, up until, like, WrestleMania weekends, was the most attended Evolve show of all time. Like, they were able to get, like, 700 people into the arena. Like, it's listed as 800, it's probably closer to 700. It's kind of insane.
Well, with,
and this is what happened to him.
With Gargano's injury in mind, we should note that the original plans for this Dragon Gate USA card were announced on January 9th with the announcement that the Young Bucks of Matt and Nick Jackson were returning to Dragon Gate USA for a Dream six-man tag match with the Young Bucks and AR Fox against Ronan of Johnny Gargano, Chuck Taylor, and Rich Swann. That same day, it was announced that BB Hulk would be taking on Sami Callihan. But after the incident at Evolve 10, January 23rd, it was announced that GGUSA champion Johnny Gargano will be unable to make it to open the Golden Gate due to his back injury. However, Low Key was added to Dragon Gate USA. He'll be making his debut on this show and wrestling BB Hulk, which means that Sami Callihan will resume his feud with AR Fox in an anything goes match. And on top of that, the Young Bucks are now going to be wrestling Chuck Taylor and Rich Swann. So it's a real what could have been with this show. Mike, I'm so bummed we never got that six-man tag.
Yeah. And that could have been, like, such a big match. But, like, when it rain, it pours with WWE. Like, it's not just one thing that goes wrong with it. First, it's Johnny Gargano, and this card's going to be changing a lot more before we start talking about the show itself. But getting the Bucks back, especially given, like, how bad their TNA stint went, and then them going back on the Indies, really kind of doing Ring of Honor and Chikara, but now starting to do Gabe stuff, and it's definitely something that's gonna be cool to like kind of follow as like this. I would argue is like the real like popular culture ascent of the Bucks starts pretty much with the calendar changing into 2012.
Oh yes, there is stuff that we'll be able to timeline specifically with the Young Bucks throughout this year that I think directly can be linked to their success today. Much like, as that is really the big Dragon USA news and notes that we have, we do need to shift to Japan for a second to get a larger context of what is going on in Dragon Gate. But also, Mike, quickly, just for historical purposes, we want to run down this Wrestle Kingdom 6 card, January 4th, 2012, at the Tokyo Dome. Mike, this show opened with Apollo 55, Devitt, and Taguchi defeating Davey Richards and Rocky Romero to win the IWGP Junior Tag Team titles. There was a big 8-man cluster of junior heavyweight wrestlers. Match 3, Kazuchika Okada defeats Yoshihashi, and that will be an incredibly important match in the history of New Japan Pro Wrestling. We also saw Motokatsu motherfucking Funaki and Masayuki Kono defeating Wataru Inoue and Yuji Nagata. MVP and Shelton Benjamin defeated Masato Tanaka and Yujiro Takahashi. Hiroshi Tenzan and Satoshi Kojima defeated Bad Intentions. Hiroki Goto defeated Pro Wrestling Noah's Takashi Sagira. Togi Makabe went over on Yoshihiro Takayama. Go Shiozaki and Naomichi Marufuji of Marufuji. Naomichi Marufuji, there is the clean take for all you audiophiles out there. Go Shiozaki and Naomichi Marufuji of Pro Wrestling Noah defeated Shinsuke Nakamura and Toru Yano. Keiji Muto defeated Tetsuya Naito in 22 minutes. And your main event, Hiroshi Tanahashi defeats Minoru Suzuki. After the match, Kazuchika Okada comes out, makes a challenge to Tanahashi, and the entire Tokyo Dome laughs in his face.
Yeah, this is... now we're kind of in modern history in a way. Like, this is, like, ancient history for, like, Dragon Gate terms or Dragon Gate USA terms, but this is, like, we just talked about New Japan Ascendant. Arguably, this is the show that starts their modern history. You could argue Ustream, but the Rainmaker gimmick being debuted and him making the challenge that would happen at New Beginning 2012 is definitely like the era shifting. And it's something that with like the company, like they sold 23,000 tickets, and it's insane to like think about like they started from there. I remember like hearing that the Gaijin work events like in 2009, 2010 that the company might close, and they're already starting to rebound. You have a lot of like Noah help on those shows. This definitely was like a period that everyone kind of was like a period of good feelings without the Japanese scene. It could be like things that I would argue that the scene came together after Fukushima and 311. So everyone was kind of on the same page, and a lot of people put like past egos aside. And that's kind of how like this card feels like, you know, like you have a lot of no participation. You have some all Japan precipitation. We're both having issues.
Yeah, here. Well, you're looking for participation is the word.
Participation.
You're looking for.
That's it. Participation. Yeah. Yep. I am not going to do a clean take. I'm just going to keep on going. And it's interesting because you have like it's something also about like Minoru Suzuki as like the big outsider at the time, and he never stopped kind of being the big outsider. So it's a cool show. Like, and it was like this is the kickoff of their 40th anniversary year. And it's just kind of a wild thing to think about. Like, this was, like, nestled into the Observer for that week and how, you know, that's not going to be the case for New Japan for much longer.
No, we are about to see the complete and utter domination of New Japan and the Wrestling Observer newsletter. We will shift to Dragon Gate now for just a few notes that pertain directly to Dragon Gate USA. I should note, I buried the lead a little bit. I had my notes incorrect last week. We talked about the December 1st Korakuen show where Akira Tozawa and BB Hulk won the vacant Twin Gate titles over Kagetora and Susumu Yokosuka. In my mind, Kagetora and Susumu became Jimmies in early 2012, but I was incorrect. As of December 1st, 2011, it is Jimmy Kagetora and Jimmy Susumu. So that is important to note off the bat. And then the Dragon Gate calendar kicks off on January 9th, Kobe Sambo Hall. No matches really need to be discussed here, but we did get the rules of what would become a reoccurring theme in 2012 and 2013, the Shima Royale. which was a six-man match. We'll start with two competitors as a singles match. Two more will enter in one-minute intervals. For the first 10 minutes, two-count pinfall rules are in effect. After the 10 minutes are up, it will change to a traditional three-count. Over-the-top rules are in play, and the winner will get to choose a time and place to challenge Shima for the Open the Dream Gate title. And we would see the first one of those on January 15th at the Osaka Prefectural Gymnasium number 2, where Jimmy Susumu defeated Chihiro Tamanaga, Cyber Kong, Dragon Kid, Gamma KZ, Naruki Doi, Shingo Takagi, Stalker Ichikawa, and Super Shenlong to win the first Shima Royale. He would challenge Shima for the Dreamgate belt on February 5th in Hakata Star Lanes. And we also had a main event of Tozawa and Hulk defending the Twin Gate belts over Masaki Mochizuki and Masato Yoshino.
So I love the Shima Royale. I think it's such like a cool idea, especially for someone that, you know, I mean, this is Shima. This would be his last Dreamgate title run. Like, it adds a little bit of spice and a little bit of unpredictability to it. And it, kind of like when they did, like, the Yoshino lottery, when Don Fuji, like, said, oh, I found this ball. And they were like, no, that ball wasn't even in the box. Like, it has my name on it. I'm the new challenger. So, like, they were able to do interesting stuff about it. And, you know, especially given what's going to be happening 4 days later, it makes sense that Shima would choose this as the way of choosing his partners.
Yes, very Shima-esque. Not even from an ego sense. It's just a convoluted idea to get him a world title challenger, and for that, we salute him. And then we move to January 19th, Tokyo Korakuen Hall, the last show that we'll discuss here. Mike, I'll run down this full card for you, because it is a fascinating card to look at with 8 years of hindsight. The opener was Eita Kobayashi and Yosuke Watanabe defeating Kotoka and Super Shenlong. Don Fuji defeated Chihiro Tamanaga in match number 2, and Yasushi Kanda defeated Super Shisa in match number 3. We saw the Junction 3 tandem of Gamma and Masato Yoshino defeating the unaffiliated Cyber Kong, who was at this point trying to prove himself to Junction 3. We saw Kong and Mochizuki take the fall there. There was an Open the Triangle Gate match with the Blood Warriors team of KZ, Naruki Doi, and Tomahawk TT, who was fake Naoki Tanizaki starting on this show, as Tanizaki would miss about 6 months of action with a shoulder injury. So they dressed Tomahawk TT up identical to Naoki Tanizaki and tried to defend the Twin Gate, or the Triangle Gate belts, rather, against Kenes Kenichiro Rai and Taku Iwasa. This match ended in DQ, and after the match, referee Yagi decided that the belts would be vacant and that they would have to wrestle again to decide the proper champion. And then, Mike, your main event, 10-man tag loser leaves unit match, where Junction 3 of Dragon Kid, Jimmy Kagetora, Jimmy Susumu, Shingo Takagi, and Yamato defeated the Blood Warrior side of Akira Tozawa, BB Hulk, Shima, Genki Horiguchi, and Ryo Saito after Cyber Kong came out, attacked Junction 3, and then attacked Shima, linking up with Akira Tozawa and BB Hulk, and ousting Shima from Blood Warriors.
This is the big mutiny. This is the big thing that is like the last major beat in the Blood Warriors Junction 3 feud until the concluding match. Kong continually playing people. That's kind of been his storyline over the last few years, was that he would fluctuate so much between units because no one could trust him, and that he was just a very kind of like double-handed person in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, he was a reason that other units have broken up. He's like, remember, like, they started like Junction 3 by Kong saying that he wouldn't join unless they beat him, and then he beat him, and he's like, nope, I'm a member of Blood Warriors, and he gets kicked out of Blood Warriors. Masaki Mochizuki's a fool, because he fall for this, like, what, 4 times?
Exactly.
It feels like, yeah. And, of course, like, the big moment of the big turn on Shima, when they ousted Shima, one of those, like, great infinity moments of Shima kind of like sagging around, and they picking up the chair, smashing it over his head. They love they love popping out the seat in the chairs, you know, like they love doing that in, and then getting a brutal final flash, and then pulling Kagetora on top of Shima, expelling him, and then you kind of get to see like Shima left lying, and then Don Fuji, his sworn partner, sworn brother, coming to his aid, and we now are in the final chapter of this feud.
So after the match, and I will read this from the iHeartDigi recap, Mochizuki yelled at Kong. Kong called Mochi an old man. Tozawa said they would take the Dreamgate back from the exiled Shima. Horiguchi got in Tozawa's face and questioned their actions, and after some arguing, Tozawa said he wanted to cut to the chase and end Junction 3 next month. The Yoshida-style match will return for a 7-versus-7 unit disbands match, and then Junction 3 closed the show by mentioning that Rich Swann would be back next month, but Pac isn't returning their emails. And Mike, before you sound off on that eventful post-match, I will say that the final note we have from Japan is that a few days later in KBS Hall, Doi, Kanda, and Kong defeated Mochizuki, Yoshino, and Gamma in a loser leaves unit match, and so Gamma left Junction 3 weeks before the final unit disbands match between the two units.
Yeah, and this is one that happened because Gamma was hurt, I believe.
Yes, he had a neck injury.
Like that. Yeah, so this is one that does not really play into the immediate after effects of this feud, but this Yoshida-style elimination match, 7-versus-7, we'll talk about this more when we move towards Mania Weekend next week, but what a time, what one of the big matches of the last decade of Dragon Gate, and just like setting this up here, like 7-versus-7 elimination tag rules where it's the Yoshida style, so you're able, there's no loser revive here, so it's just basically you pin and you're out, and everyone just kind of coming down to like this great conclusion in the match and then the post-match stuff. Like we'll be doing like the last big change and big unit shift other than like smaller units as coming out of this match as Blood Warriors and Junction 3 is going to be coming to a close.
Before, and I promise you, we will open the Golden Gate in just a minute, but before we do that, it was a Wrestle Reunion weekend, and we do need to look at the scene happening in Southern California this weekend, because there was a Wrestle Reunion show and a PWG card as well, and I will ever so quickly run down both of those, starting with the Wrestle Reunion show brought on by Pro Wrestling Superstars that saw Adam Page wrestle Eric Royal to a no contest in the opener. Mick Foley was the special guest referee for the New Age Outlaws versus the Steiner Brothers in a match that I'm sure was just absolutely horrific. There was a European rules match, however, that sounds much better between Fit Finlay and Colt Cabana. I would like to go back and rewatch that. That sounds good. The Unholy Alliance of Mikey Whipwreck and Yoshihiro Tajiri defeated Caleb Conley and Cedric Alexander. The show-stealing match of maybe the entire weekend, Masquerita Dorada defeated Demas 316. Kevin Steen went over on Tommy Dreamer in a street fight, and Roderick Strong went over on Jake Manning before your two real main events of the evening, Davey Richards defeating Harry Smith, and El Generico and the Great Sasuke defeating the Young Bucks. Mike, have you seen any footage from this show?
You know what? This is a show that I know in 2012 was like, you know, this is weird enough for me to watch, but I think it just got lost in the morass of trying to find everything else. You know, like, I wanted to go see that European rules match. Like, that seems like that's a really cool thing. I wonder, Wrestle Reunion, this was put on by High Spots,
yes,
right?
Yes, this is on the High Spots Network.
I might go seek this out the next time that, like, I have a quiet time and, like, I want to watch something different.
Yeah.
Just because, like, especially, like, the Demas 316 thing.
That was, like, that match is incredible. I mean, obviously, Masquerita Dorada got signed eventually, I think, just because Naylor was yelling up such a storm in Florida that they had to do something to shut him up. But the European rules match is a lot of fun. The minis match is a lot of fun. I like Davey versus Harry quite a bit, and then the Generico Sasuke versus Young Bucks match. While it isn't spectacular, it is a really fitting sort of showcase style of match.
Well, I mean, you're dealing with Sasuke at that time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we also had PWG's Kurt Russell Reunion 3 on January 29th, 2012. I love this show so much, but I do have a small critique with it, as I'll explain as we go down the card. But the Fightin' Taylor boys of Brian Cage Taylor and Ryan Taylor defeated Chris Cadillac and Famous B in the opener. Jimmy Susumu defeated BB Hulk, and the Young Bucks defeated Davey Richards and Harry Smith. There was a match where future Dragon Gate alumni Willie Mack defeated Naruki Doi in 12 minutes. That match is a ton of fun. As is
that match rules.
Yeah, that match rules. Look, Willie Mack in 2012, what a blissful, joyful wrestler. And it's crazy to think that he didn't break out in a big way after all of the great matches he had that year.
Yeah, it's that plus having Naruki Doi, the the person who understands territory wrestling better than anyone else in 2012. Like, it's just a blast of a match.
There was an 8-man with B-Boy, Candice LeRae, Cedric Alexander, and Masquerita Dorada defeating Demas 316, Joey Ryan, Peter Avalon, and Rey Rosas. Mike, the result of this match still blows me away to this day. The Rocknest Monsters, Johnny Goodtime and Johnny Yuma, defeated the Spiked Mohicans of Shima and Ricochet. Can you believe that?
And it's even something where, like, hey, I understand that Rocknest Monsters were, like, kind of the house tag team. They were the SoCal tag team that was around at this time. But come on. Come on. Shima must have been in a really good mood.
I'm sure he got a nice check for that loss.
Do you think he really got a nice check for that loss?
The Super Dragon will pay one man and one man only, and that man is Shima.
There we go. I mean, he is a former Battle of Los Angeles champion.
Exactly. And the semi-main event, Masaaki Mochizuki defeated Roderick Strong. In the main event, 6-man dream match, El Generico, Masato Yoshino, and Pac defeated Akira Tozawa, Kevin Steen, and Super Dragon. And my one complaint about this show is that this is one of the best matches in the history of the U.S. Indies. If this 6-man happened in Reseda, it is a 5-star match without a shadow of a doubt. But the crowd is just not hot enough for this match, and it kills me because I love this match so much, and I don't think the people in attendance appreciated the match as much as they should have.
Oh, not as much as they should have. I mean, it's the Midnight Violence Collection appetite, or it's the appetite for the Midnight Violence Collection. I think that's what they connection. I think that's what they ended up calling it, and just like a wild match. I mean, a lot of people like will forget, but El Generico really got his international start in Dragon Gate. So like he's familiar with all these guys. He's kind of the glue of this match in a way.
Oh yeah.
And I mean like the top two matches on the show, like it's a shame that you had the crowd that everyone hated. Everyone hated the West End that they did this at. Like notably, like Excalibur was burying it throughout the show. Like it seemed like it was a very weird weekend.
Yeah, that is one way to say it. In a very weird show, as 50 minutes into this podcast, we are finally ready to open the Golden Gate 2012.
All right, so let's do this again. This is Open the Golden Gate 2012. This is from the Westin Los Angeles Airport Hotel, Los Angeles, California. Listed attendance was 550. Don't have a solid number here, but did not look like 550 to me. Dragon Gate number, I'm guessing it was probably about 350 or so, would you say?
That's a safe bet.
Yeah. It just was one of the things like this. And then just, like, overall, like, I wanted to get into this before on the show itself. Very, like, interesting vibe on this show. Like, it felt this show more so than, like, any other shows they've had before. Did you get, like, I got a huge vibe of, like, this was, like, a spot show in a way. Like, this felt like a spot show. And other than, like, the things that tied in towards the end, it felt like it was almost completely out of continuity. Or it started a new continuity for DGUSA. Was that just like my overreading thing?
I'm going to disagree slightly because I think had Rich Swann showed up, the Bucks versus Ronin match would have been some sort of story. They had been teasing Doi and Yoshino interactions throughout most of 2011. Fox versus Callahan was an ongoing story. Pac versus Tozawa was a rematch. And then you had the storyline implications of the main event. So for me, it was a continuation from Freedom Fight.
It just like, maybe that is for me that like, because only 1/3 of Ronin was there, because it was just Sami Callihan, it did kind of feel like at least like the local or United States based like talent seems to be a little bit less so here. And instead you have matches that for all intents and purposes, you have three of the last four matches on the show were basically, or three of the last five matches on the show were completely like Dragon Gate related, you know? And then you had like other stuff going on that felt kind of like WrestleMania weekendy to me. It's not a bad show.
Well, I think that is fair. I think it actually feels like a WrestleMania weekend type card, even if it's not a WrestleMania show. But I also think that is partially just going to a territory where they had not been before, branching out from the Northeast and the Midwest. And because of that, There was a bit of a feeling out process there, but as we go along in this show, I was a huge fan of pretty much everything.
No, I'm with you on that. That we start off the show with a video recapping what we talked about earlier, that we have the DGUSA and Evolve Union And that leads us straight into the opening matchup. Low Ki defeating BB Hulk in 10 minutes and 50 seconds with the Warrior Way. And we're now in the Low Ki era. Gabe and Low Ki have patched things up. We now have the World Warrior and DG USA.
Look, I fucking love Low Ki, and I'll say the F word when I say it, okay? He is seemingly an impossible person to be around, a very dumb guy, but one of my favorite wrestlers ever. And I am probably a bigger fan of post-prime Low Ki than most. I think he had a match with Sami Callihan a few years ago at AAW that is one of the best matches in AAW history. It's really up there as like a top five match of all time. Ki and Hulk came out here, and with the exception of maybe the Evolve shows that Bryan Danielson worked, I think had a more authentic Evolve match than anything else in the promotion's history. Like, this was like a Battle Arts transplant match happening on the opening of a Dragon Gate USA show, and I loved it. I thought this was such a great way to start the show.
Yeah, and it was, like, so interesting because you had Low Ki on his most Low Ki bullshit just kind of, like, steamrolling, and then every once in a while you could tell that BB Hulk, like, was a little tight, saying, like, come on, dude.
Well,
come on, dude.
I mean, Ki goes over BB Hulk here, and this is Hulk who steamrolled clean through the Summer Adventure Tag League, was really, for the first time in his career, like, a legitimate main eventer. One half of the Open the Twin Gate Champions, and Ki destroys him. And I know that annoyed people at the time, and rightfully so. But I am Team Low Ki, and I am okay with this.
And it's something with how, if it was just this and then things weren't followed up on, I feel like everyone would have been completely justified. But there were ways that things were going to go. Gabe and Loki's relationship would remain okay long enough to go through some of these routes. So I was okay with it. It was something that, like, BB Hulk didn't even go for, like, a single EVO, didn't even make a play for the first flash. It was just, like, a kick battle that eventually Loki won the kick battle and went with the Warrior Way and won. I thought this was a blast of a start, and it's something that I was one of those guys in 2012, but just like watching back at this was like a fun match. Like, it very much, this was like the most WrestleMania weekend feeling match and the match that comes after this, but I ended up having a good time with this. I went 3.25 stars on this. Like, it's hard for this match for me with the way it is to like go higher, but I had a thoroughly great time watching this match.
3.75, Mike. I am going to be much higher on all of the Low Ki stuff that we watched than you, because I really think he is just, oh my god, he's so good. And we'll get into it, I think, especially on the Miami shows. There is a part of me that will continue to defend Ki for the way he handles himself, because I ultimately think I would rather have a wrestling industry with more Low Kis than Ethan Pages and Effies. And I know that's not a popular stance, but Ki protects his image and protects himself. And because of that, whenever this man is in the ring, I fear for his opponent's life.
No, that's fair. That's fair. It's something that, like, it has a different and very, like, needed vibe that's, like, added to this promotion that very much, like, Dave actually reviews the show and talks about this as a promotion that's, like, lost a lot of steam. And I can't disagree with that, but having someone like Low Ki coming in like this and the Young Bucks coming in right after this was, like, a much-needed breath of fresh air with how 2011 ended.
Absolutely.
And then after that, Ricochet is wondering what's up with Blood Warriors. This is a big plot point on the story. But Sheamus says, oh, the match with focus on our match later and is very cagey. It's worth noting that Ricochet was not in Japan when the breakup happened.
Yes.
When he was kicked
very
out.
Important.
So some things in this that I feel like they did a great job. And is one of the things that I was watching the series in the context of. I wanted to see how well they were able to really meld what's going on in Japan, what's going on here. Some places they didn't do such a great job of, but just like having a quick 30-second thing with that, I felt like was pretty important, and I liked that they were willing to do that.
So I once heard Gabe in an interview say that he found it incredibly hard to book during the Blood Warriors versus Junction 3 time period because everyone was in one of two units, but I thought that would be a benefit for him. He wouldn't have to worry about, you know, getting guys from Warriors and World 1 on the same show. It was kind of like, well, you can put Pac and Yamato in the same match. Like, they're in the same unit. And I don't think that example ever happened, but you get my point. And it surprised me when he said that, because it would seem like such a benefit. And it's not like he's booking Gamma or Cyber Kong or these guys that are bouncing in and out of units. He was booking right. The top guys that were affiliated from day one until the unit disbanded with the same unit. So it was weird for me to hear Gabe complain about that once, because I thought that would be such a benefit to him. And I thought he did a really good job keeping continuity of Blood Warriors and Junction 3.
And on top of that, like, you only have two sides here. You're not, like, dealing with, World 1, Real Hazard. You're not dealing with Warriors. You're not dealing with, like, everything and trying to figure things out here. You have two sides. And you could even make it even more simple, because you have Rich Swann, who could be the bridge between Junction 3 and Ronin. So they're basically one side. And you could probably do something with DUF, putting him on Blood Warrior side. Like you could even simplify this even more. So, like, I don't get that. And the only major player that he was not booking at the time was Shingo.
Yeah.
So, like,
and Shingo was Junction 3 the entire time, so it would have made a difference.
Yeah, yeah. So I felt like that was something that I was wondering about when we started watching 2011. It would have been easier if they said, like, that Ronin were Junction 3 affiliates, and I don't think they needed to. Like, that was something that I thought, like, in January, like, how is this going to play out watching January 2011? Didn't need to. Maybe it would have helped DUF more if they were Blood Warriors affiliates. You know?
Possibly, but I still maintain I like the way DUF has been presented thus far.
Yeah, no. I mean, Blood, maybe they would make more sense as Matt Blanky affiliates, but we'll get into that when we get into
very
that.
Very soon.
So, very soon. Then we have, coming out to the ring is Chuck Taylor. He is by his lonesome because he addresses that Rich Swann has missed his plane flight. And then he said he's willing to face one of the Jacksons and have a one-on-one match. Matt Jackson comes out. They say that they are rock stars, and they don't do singles matches. They come here for the Young Bucks, and they'll see the Young Bucks. So then they jump on, and it's like, we'll make this a handicap match. And soon enough, then Scorpio Sky comes out making the save, setting up Young Bucks versus Chuck Taylor and Scorpio Sky. And decent way of booking themselves out of the Rich Swann situation. And I know that the Rich Swann situation is one of the more, like, contentious times in this promotion.
Yeah, we talked to some people that worked this show, and it made us count our blessings for the future Rich Swann matches that we'll get, because Gabe was fully ready to fire Rich Swann after this. And we've talked really since Swann debuted about how we feel like Gabe really undervalued him and didn't push him enough. And there are shows, you know, where he gets squashed by Brody Lee, and it's like, well, what's the point of that? This guy is supposed to be one of your future building blocks. And after Swann missed his flight here, I mean, thank God it wasn't the Ronin six-man tag that Swann missed. It was just the altered tag match. But still, that's a big opportunity of Chuck Taylor and what would have been Rich Swann against the Young Bucks, the Bucks who are working in Ring of Honor but without a contract at this time, working Chikara, working PWG. This was a really big match, but Swann was not there. But honestly, I thought Scorpio Sky was terrific in this match. So for as much as I like Swann, his absence wasn't felt greatly in this contest.
Yeah, yeah. So the Young Bucks won in 12 minutes with more bang for your buck on Swann. I like this match a whole lot. I thought that it was something that they did make this into. The Bucks were heels at the time in California, so they really played that up, and very much like a proto Bucks match that you would be seeing much later on in the decade. And you're absolutely right. I thought Scorpio Sky looked great here. Like, I'm surprised, other than like the price of a plane flight, that Gabe wouldn't be like, okay, I want you now on the roster, because he looked great. He hit his crazy taupe where he clears the ring with like the most height I've seen out of basically everyone but Dragon Daya. And he fits in, and him and Chuck Taylor have good chemistry, and this turned up to be a really fun tag match. I went 3.5 stars on it.
I'm right at 3.5 as well. I think that is the definition of this match, is a 3.5 star match. All four guys worked really well together. I love when Chuck Taylor puts on his work rate hat and works really hard against a team like the Young Bucks. And the other thing that stood out to me watching this show was, you know, the Bucks are on a show now with Low-Ki and with AR Fox and Sammy Callahan and John Davis. If you look at the last GGUSA shows that the Young Bucks worked, Mike, this is a show with TJP versus Brad Allen, and Jack Evans and Jimmy Jacobs versus Brian Kendrick and Paul London, John Moxley versus Tommy Dreamer. I mean, they missed an entire era, if not two, in the time they were gone, and then they felt right back at home when they worked this match.
They did, and I think it maybe helped with someone that they already like would have worked Chuck Taylor a lot. They would have worked Scorpio Sky a ton, and it felt like they didn't like miss a step whatsoever. And there was like even little things where Scorpio tried to fight out the Finley roll and the more bang for your buck that made this like finish look extra good. Like, it was something that usually when you see the more bang for your buck, you're like, okay, Finley roll 450 moonsault, we're out of here. But it actually put a little bit of doubt that you could think for like a second, maybe this isn't enough to put away Scorpio Sky. And it's great to see the Bucks back. Like, this is something that the tag team division desperately needed at this time.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a bummer that they stick around, but not in the immediate future. It takes about another year for them to come back and be full-time with Dragon Gate USA.
Yes, yes. I think it was announced before the show that even though they're back here, they will not be on the Dragon Gate USA shows in Miami. They'll be working the Ring of Honor.
Unfortunately.
So, unfortunately. Boy, that'll be a fun conversation to have in a couple weeks, by the way. All right, so then we cut backstage. It is John Davis saying that he's going to establish Sonnens and building off of Evolve 10, where he called out Finley. He said he hoped Finley was watching. And then we had probably the most peculiar music choice they ever had for a music video, as it was Chasing the Dragon, one of the sleeper hits of 2011, is now on DVD in case. Was I the one who thought like this music just did not fit whatsoever? Like it was like folksy music happening as like, and it went on forever for this, like this music video.
More so than the music, I'm just amazed at how long these DVD video packages are, because it's not like the PWG previews where it's like 5 minutes long and it's worth it, but it's not a teaser. It's a very awkward length of a preview. It makes me kind of uncomfortable every single time they show one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just wild, the fact that they would have this. And, you know, I mean, it's something that it eats up a lot of time on the show, that even though the show felt really breezy, like, you could cut out about 15 minutes of videos that are completely unnecessary, you know? Like, it's just, and it's the thing I brought up at the beginning, that do they really need to advertise for the people that are the big fans that are buying every show anyways? Like, that's always going to be a thing. Oh, wait, no, Indianapolis was not on pay-per-view. Indianapolis was only a DVD release.
Yes.
So, okay, never mind. I'm wrong there. My bad. Then we have a singles match. Masato Ishino versus Naruki Doi. And it was Masato Ishino winning with a Soul Nascente Kai in 16 minutes and 7 seconds. And we got something that is very charming in retrospect, as all during this match in the slow periods, we had Lenny Leonard shouting out Jay and I Heart DG talking about the history of Masato Yoshino and Naruki Doi. I ended up really liking this match as well.
This match was awesome. This is not their best singles match together, but weirdly it might be their most penetrable or accessible singles match, because it was all action. Yeah. I mean, it's like a TV match that Doi and Yoshino worked here. And you're right, in the Dragon Gate USA Newswires, Jay did a big write-up of the history between these two, and it was nice to see Lenny give him a plug there, and, you know, 8 years later, they're working together on commentary, which is a nice thing to see. Mike, are you aware that this is the last Naruki Doi match in Dragon Gate USA history?
No!
I love
territory champion Naruki Doi. Why? Why?
This is something,
why?
Especially after Miami, we are going to be keeping tabs on these guys that just disappear. Because, you know, Shingo has been gone for a while, but Shingo will come back. Dragon Kid, his run is up after the United weekend at the start of 2011. And then you get into this point where there was somebody, I believe, on the last set of shows that worked their final weekend. Maybe not, but now you've got Doi coming up on his finale, Yoshino and...
Well, Brody Lee. Brody Lee's done.
Brody Lee is done, and you know, you've got Doi's done here, Yoshino and Hulk are coming up on their exits, Yamato's almost done, so these, you know, staples of the promotion are leaving very soon, and there's just no Japanese talent coming in to restock that pond, so we'll really start to see the transformation from Dragon Gate USA into Evolve Light as we go along in 2012, but I thought this match, for what it was 3.5 stars, and a very, very efficient match. I really like this.
Yeah, yeah, and it's something where these two guys have had 12 matches throughout Dragon Gate history. I'm not going to look back into Second Doi. Just going to say, in Dragon Gate history, they've had 12 matches, and it's a matchup that, like, has been put ever since, like, matches that have happened since then, Case, just for a second. Opened the Dream Gate title match at Oda City Gymnasium in 2018. Cork and Hall for King of Gate 2016. Bodymaker 1 in Osaka in 2013. Cork and Hall in 2013. Kobe Sambo Hall. This is a match that, and then looking like behind it, Fukuoka. Basically, the only place this match did not happen was in Aichi, Nagoya, and in Kobe Kenning Hall. Like, this is, like, one of the big matches, and, you know, it's one of the ones that it's not as good as, like, their Dream or Brave Gate matches that they would have, but it's, I think I like it more than their 2016 King of Gate match. I think that this is a better match than this, and I went 3.5 as well, and it just was something that's very interesting to me that across their career, 12 singles matches, when we talked about, like, Masato Yoshino and Akira Tozawa not having very many singles matches, they went to this wall a lot. And it's very interesting the way it played off. They did go 3 years without a match between 2013 and 2016.
I like between this match and the Yoshino versus Shima match on the prior show, just the different style that Yoshino brought to the table. One that I think if he had to work on a more televised weekly basis, we'd see more from him, where it was a high effort style, but not really high intensity, if that makes sense. I mean, he was working smarter, not harder, and produce some really good matches out of it. I really liked seeing this different side of Yoshino on these prior two shows.
Yeah, and I think it worked really well with, as I've called the territorial star, Naruki Doi. Like, the two of them kind of came together, and this is a match that very easily could have been the main event of, like, your territory in the 80s, like, their big, like, quarterly show. Like, that's what this match was kind of worked like, right? Like, you could see this along the same lines of when, like, Ric Flair would come into World Class and have a match with Von Erich. Like, that's kind of like the style I would have put this, the Dragon System style of that. And I feel like it worked really well. And it's something, especially now in 2020, I think I've said this before, the Uda Yoshino is one of my favorite moves. I know he absolutely can't pull off anymore, but whenever I see it, I write down Uda Yoshino because it's such a sweet move. And I was happy to see it here. And I went 3.5 stars as well. This was a whole lot of fun.
My one other note of this match is you mentioned that move. I really liked the Sol Naciente Kai finish that they did here, where it seemed like Yoshino really had to fight to hook the leg that he does, that extra little maneuver on the submission to get Doi to the mat to get him to tap. It was just an extra struggle there that I don't typically see from Yoshino. And again, I really like this. I like seeing this version of Yoshino that is just rarely present just because of the pace that he normally works at.
Yeah, and it's something that I wish, during this time period, if the Sol Naciente worked, he would then hook the legs with the Kai, and that would be it. I like that as, like, oh, this did not work there. So it's one of those things that it developed kind of like a super finish, but in the same way, it puts you more invested in the first Sol Naciente, and then the second one, you're like, is he going to hook the leg? Is he going to go for the Kai here? And it's something that I, like, would miss, because you just now get to a point where he locks it in 3 times, and that usually does the trick. I like the stepping it up that we had with that.
Absolutely. Well, Mike, what's going on with Larry Dallas in the scene?
Well, Larry Dallas in the scene have a problem. And you know what that problem is, Case?
What's that, Mike?
The problem is that Scott Reed won't get out of the dang hot tub. Here. And that's all that I have in my notes is Scott Reed refuses to leave the hot tub.
Good for Scott Reed. Good for him. He doesn't need to work this show. He's relaxing. This scene is going to Hollywood, and I love to see it.
The Hollywood scene. And then we had Aaron Fox. He's mad that Sammy ran through Sabu at the last Evolve show. So now he's going to go against Sammy Callahan, revisiting that feud. And I thought that was, you know, for not a strong promo guy, Aaron Fox is not a great promo. I feel like that this was actually a pretty effective one from him.
Well, then it led straight into a match that, I don't know about you, but this Sammy Callahan versus Aaron Fox match made me hate Sabu so much.
Yeah, because this match.
This match was so good. Oh my god, it was great. And it's just, after the Midwest, it's like, okay, we're really going to do Sabu again. After the Northeast, are you kidding me? This is the AR Fox show. This is the AR Fox feud. Oh, this match was great. Take it away, Mike.
So this was originally an Everything Goes match. Now it is a tables match where AR Fox lost to Sammy Callahan in 10 minutes with a powerbomb through the outside. And boy, were they just, like, going at it from the start. Air Fox, like, dives on a tope suicida and lands dead onto a barricade. That looked like it was terrible. And then, like, the table matches usually suck. Like, just in general, table matches suck. But instead, there's like, oh, we're just going to murder each other, and then we'll finally put one of each other through a table. And it's a table that was pretty much, like, busted from the get-go, so they had to get pretty inventive with it. They used a lot of barricades. They used the table around and finished with Sammy Callahan on the outside picking up A.R. Fox and throwing him through the table and his head hitting the back of the barricade. It's something where this is like a 3.25, 3.5-star tables match. But when you consider like the whole scope of tables matches, that probably makes this one the top 10 table matches of all time.
The intensity that Sammy Callahan possessed at this point in his career. Like, I've been in love with rewatching this era of Sammy because it kind of validated my opinion that pre-Solomon Crow era Sammy Callahan was awesome. And I thought that way when he was signed in 2013, and I'm glad that all of this stuff still holds up because he is really a breath of fresh air in this company. We've talked about how well he's worked with the Japanese talent, whether it's Tozawa or Mochizuki or Doi. And seeing him here in what has been a really hyped, almost year-long feud with AR Fox at this point, and they worked it as such. They worked with an intensity and a pace that was needed to fit this feud with, you know, Fox jumping him at the bell, doing a springboard 450 to the floor, which is a really nasty move. I mean, it just looks painful. You see Fox at one point set up the guardrail in between the barrier and the apron. He did a somersault senton onto that, or he did a kickflip onto the guardrail, and then Sammy Callahan came right back and powerbombed him from the ring onto that guardrail before powerbombing him into the table for the finish. I went 4 stars flat. Mike, this is the exact type of intensity that I wish Sammy Callahan still worked at, because I really loved this match.
It's just something that it's an intensity, it's at a clip. Like, this is not a match to overstate its welcome. They went at it for 10 minutes, and that was it. And they were able to, like, kind of get off like this. Like, if this was the blow-off match for that feud, I'd be like, you know what? This feud actually worked. Now it's distilled down to, like, the two main actors in it, you know? It's just something that, like, you see this, and it does get you, like, so pissed about 2011 with Sabu. Because, like, they didn't need him to begin with. It just was Gabe being fixated on Sabu. I hate it. But I love this match.
The only other tables match that I can think of that is even on the same level as this is Royal Rumble 2000 Hardy Boys versus the Dudleys. I think if we're talking straight tables matches, that's the only one in competition. And if I'm missing one, please let me know. Tweet at us at Open Voice Gate with your favorite tables matches of all time. But I really think this is an upper echelon match for a gimmick that is largely terrible.
Yeah, no, it's... So, Case, you know that one of the promotions I've really gotten into and over COVID is one that's, it's not necessarily in your neck of the woods, but it's in your general area. It's Paradigm Pro Wrestling.
Yes.
And I've gotten into it. It's a very kind of charming promotion in a lot of ways. It is something that is completely weird because it does like hardcore, like IWA Mid-South hardcore, but at the same time, they also, like, do UWFI, and they did this match that was called, like, the Portals of Pain match, which was best out of seven, either through doors and tables, and it just was, like, kind of a mess where, like, they had to call off the last table and restart the match. Like, it's such a low level of how much, like, bad table matches and door matches that there are, that when you see one that's, like, it's brutally worked, but it's simply worked, and you're like, this is a stipulation that makes no sense whatsoever. Why should there ever be a table match to begin with? Like, makes no sense whatsoever. But when you see it work like this way, you're like, okay, this actually was a good time.
4 stars. It's frustrating. 4 stars on the dot for me. Sammy Callahan continues to really impress.
Yeah, yeah. And then we had a long WWN live promo, which cut to Susumu. Jimmy Susumu. I caught myself.
Yeah,
there.
Jimmy Susumu is the era of the Jimmy, Mike.
The era of the Jimmy is here. As is Jimmy Susumu and Masaaki Mochizuki. Masaaki Mochizuki brings up that he lost that final gate, dropped the Open the Dream Gate title to Shima, and that they're going to come back to Japan as the Open the United Gate champions. Again, when they want to let the guys do promos and subtitle, it's always generally pretty solid. Like, it was like an effective promo.
I have no complaints with it.
Yeah. And then we get into John Davis versus Caleb Conley, and the big news coming out of this match, Larry Dallas has been granted a WWN manager's license. He is out there with his boy, Caleb Conley.
Obviously a cardinal sin.
I mean, it's something where it gave Chuck Taylor and Lenny Leonard stuff to talk about in commentary. You know?
Look, I've talked a lot about how much I like the DUF in hindsight. The scene, up to this point, now things could change, but the scene has not bothered me at all because I think Conley and Reed have been used sparingly, and Conley's about a year away, I think, from really turning the corner, becoming who at one point he was one of my favorite guys on the indies, but this is the John Davis show, and Davis looked good, and that's all I care about. Established dominance, baby.
And he did establish dominance. We don't even have a match time on this with Cage Match, but John Davis won with the 3 seconds around the world. Went a little long. Like, this was something that it did show off, like, Caleb Konley trying to fight back a little bit more than I would want against John Davis, but solid John Davis match. He still is establishing dominance, and as of the week of the collective, I am so excited about being able to see John Davis this weekend.
Just watching these shows, I can't believe he wasn't signed to FCW. It doesn't make any sense. That's like, I mean, he's like the poster child for, I think, what they're looking for from the indies. Like, not overexposed, was primarily working the Florida scene. This big dude with a good look who could work, who could move, who could lift weights. Like, I don't get it. He's tailor-made for late-stage FCW.
Yeah. And he's able to, like, work different styles matches. And he's just someone that, maybe it is that he got so connected in with Gabe in the Florida indie scene that he never had, like, the big opportunity afterwards to, like, stick around somewhere, which, you know, with all, like, the trials and tribulations of him being in WN, him leaving WN, don't necessarily blame him, but they've done, like, at least, like, through, like, the first, like, few months of this, I've completely, like, the past where I did not like John Davis was a false past. I now establish dominance. I'm looking forward to For the Culture, him versus Calvin Tankman. Let's go. That is one of my, like, it's very simple. Like, John Davis is, like, and the way you book John Davis is so simple, and Gabe's getting that. Like, you have him come in here, he wrecks shop, maybe the guy fights back a little bit, but then he puts him up on his shoulders, spins him around, powerbombs him, and gets out of here. And that was my only complaint, is that this match went too long until him just destroying him. So, loved it.
Yeah, it's the weakest match on the show, but it was an effective match, so I can't complain about it.
Yeah, it's one of those things, not to pull a Lanza and do a full tease on star ratings, that it's a 2.5-star match, but it's supposed to be, like, at most a 3-star match.
Yeah, I had it right at 2.75, so we are going to meet in the middle there.
Yeah. And then we go backstage. The Young Bucks are there. They say that they are rock stars, and they're into the United Gate titles. This is going to the Heel Bucks, which actually means this is a somewhat decent promo from them. Don't think they're good babyface promos whatsoever. And, you know, we won't see them again for a while, but they want to come back and win the United Gate titles.
And then, Mike, Pac versus Akira Tozawa, the rematch.
Pac versus Akira Tozawa, the rematch, where Akira Tozawa defeats Pac with the Capture German Suplex in 16 minutes, 4.25 stars, just some of the stuff that somehow in this promotion, at least in DGUSA, they managed to bloody each other in a way, and it kind of takes each of the guys kind of feed off of bleeding and going to the next level. Akira Tozawa is, like, busting the eyebrow, has blood dripping down. He starts drinking his own blood, and then it finally, like, kind of, like, scabs up. But I absolutely love this match. Pac was my 2011 Dragon Gate USA MVP. Showed up on 7 of my top 10 matches and picks up right from there and here. And Tozawa gets the big pin on the guy who, just about this time last year, he was losing to in Brave Gate matches. So Tozawa is continuing to step up, and he's looking forward in 2012 to have a lot of big matches in DGUSA.
You know, I watched this match with my roommate, which I don't like to do, but we had finished up Monday Night Football last night, and I was like, I got to go watch other for the podcast tomorrow. I was like, well, what? Put it out here. Like, what do you watch? I was like, you don't want to do that. And he's like, no, bring it out. So it was this match. It was Pac versus Tozawa, and I watched it with someone who had no knowledge of either of these two men, someone who's watched wrestling in the past but not in years and doesn't know anything about the current scene. And
sure,
he was blown away by Akira Tozawa. The flipping of Pac didn't do a ton for him, but Tozawa's charisma and the repeated sentons that he did and the machine gun chops followed by the punch to the face, he lost his mind for that spot. He was all about that. And I think because he was watching the match so closely, I found myself watching this match incredibly closely, more so than I typically do. And I'm someone that's very focused when I watch these shows. But by the end of this, I was just enthralled with this match in this almost King's Road-esque pace that they worked, because the first few minutes of the match are really slow. I mean, they really take their time getting into it, and it seems like once Pac does the top rope moonsault to the floor where half his body lands on the guardrail and it looks like he's dead, from that moment on, the match really picks up in a way where the pace that these two work to close things out is just unmatched. I mean, this is, you want to talk about best wrestlers in the world, this is it. This is Dragon Gate USA, get into it, because this is top-notch professional wrestling by two of the best guys of the past decade. Two guys that can work circles around anyone. Pac is a victim of global circumstances, and Tozawa is currently a victim of creative incompetence, and it's a damn shame, because these two have only gotten better, I think, since this match. I went 4.5 with it. I loved this. I loved this whole show. I loved this match, though.
It's just like something where these two guys, like in 2020, the match would be excellent. Imagine 2016, Akira Tozawa versus Adrian Neville.
Can you imagine 2021 Pac? Or I guess we're in 2020 still. Ugh. I guess, you know, 2020 Pac versus, you know, if we could get 2016 Akira Tozawa or close to it, it'd be unbelievable.
Oh, God. Imagine if we had in Dragon Gate right now, we still had Pac and RED, and then you had Akira Tozawa as the number one in the Dragon Gate army, because he would have been the number one. Like, that's just matter of fact there with how they've treated Yamato. They would have had basically Pac, they would have Pac versus that. Like, imagine that as like a Kobe World match.
I'd be like, more imagine, than happy to. That sounds absolutely wonderful.
Giving these two guys half an hour. It could have been truly special, because like they do like little things, like they've scouted each other so well that you have the fact that Akira Tozawa goes for the repeated tope suicidas, and on the second one, Pac's like, nope, he's gonna keep on doing this if I don't stop him. He catches him into a Northern Light throw onto the floor, and then proceeds to almost kill his ankles. I don't know, like, does he have metal feet? Do we think that Pac has metal feet or metal shins? Because he does that so much throughout the years, I'm wondering, like, you have to have, like, some crazy calcified shins.
Mike, or the he's best built kick different. Pads in the world. That's as simple as this man is built different.
Yeah, this is this match is the good stuff. And it is something that, on a show that, you know, if you're able to find it, go check this match out. Because the two matches that these two guys have had so far, singles matches, have been excellent. Up opposite of each other, like, some people just have innate chemistry, and it's Akira Tozawa and Pac. Like those are like two people that are like, no matter what, these two guys are having great matches. I even remember like early Kamikaze Akira Tozawa and Pac having great exchanges.
You know,
they just work. They just work.
The last time these two wrestled in a singles match, Mercury Rising 2011, Pac got busted open right by his eye, and in this match, Tozawa got cut open right by his eye too.
Right.
So it's just a nice little moment there. Some accidental blood goes a long way in what will surely be a match that finishes in my Dragon Gate USA top 10 by the end of 2012.
I'm with you there. Like, this is a nice high watermark, but for me, it was immediately exceeded by the next match
on the same page. Take it away, Mike.
It is the Open the United Gate Champions as Ricochet, representing Blood Warriors, and the new Open the Brave Gate Champion, teaming up with his United Gate champion partner, no longer of Blood Warriors. He is unaffiliated. He is the Open the Dream Gate champion, Shima. Together, they are the Sparked Mohicans. Defeat the Junction 3 team of Masaki Mochizuki and Jimmy Susumu. And not only is this match like a tremendous match, not only is this match four guys that go for 25 minutes at like the top of their art, but the way that they like tell the story in this match, and the way that they weave in things of like, Shima just got kicked out of Blood Warriors. Ricochet, it seems like he just discovered it this day. I mean, Chuck Taylor in commentary did not know what was up with Shima until Lenny Leonard was like, oh yeah, no, they kicked him out. Tozawa and Hulk kicked him out. He's like, oh, okay. And then you have Masaki mother effing Mochizuki, one of the five best wrestlers alive right now, one of the greatest wrestlers of all time in both of our approximations, just being excellent. And then that's not even like the big star of this match here, as the finishing stretch was Shima and Jimmy Susumu. Jimmy Susumu goes for a Jumbo no Kachi Gatame that does not work. Then he gets the Schwein. He gets like his crazy face buster, gets put out with the Meteor in 24 minutes and 4 seconds. The Spike Mohicans retain case. How awesome was this match?
You know, I there's so much to like about this match. I mean, the intensity of Shima the work rate of Susumu. And I should note that, you know, we knock Shima's ego all the time, but Shima took so much offense in this match. He was great. Susumu was great. The effort of Mochizuki and Ricochet within their own partnerships was terrific. But what I really loved in this match was seeing the interactions between Mochizuki and Ricochet. Two guys that never had a singles match, two guys that never really had a high profile, you know, tag match or a program. Really, I think they're best known together for when Mochizuki was a second for Ricochet when he worked in New Japan. Like, they're just not guys that interacted all that much. And seeing them come out of the gates here swinging at one another, it shows just how far Ricochet has come over the past year, where, you know, September of 2010, he's being slowly led through this speed muscle match, and everything is just fine-tuned to make sure Ricochet looks amazing. Here he just comes out and he is on Mochizuki's level, and it is an incredible thing to see, and I thought their interactions were the highlight of what was a truly spectacular match.
And it's something that you have, like, these combinations that get a lot of interplay in this match. I think is one of the things that makes this match uniquely special. Because you talk about Mochizuki and Ricochet, I'm thinking about Susumu and Shima. Like, there's a moment where Shima does, like, his 2012 version of doing the full course, where he's going to go do Venus, Iconoclasm, and then usually it will be a Meteora. But then as soon as he gets up, as soon as Susumu's up on the turnbuckle, he goes for the Venus palm strike, and Susumu ducks it and drops down and throws an exploder, and it's just like, all right, these guys are working at a next level here. And it just, like, continued with that pace and the way that everything worked, doing, like, a 630 splash that is perfect, that's, like, pinpoint, knowing, like, okay, I want to pin Mochizuki here, so my focus on the splash is my shoulders can come across Mochizuki, and that's where the rotation's going to get me. And then the thing that got me with, like, Ricochet in this match, and it's something that I've been having an issue with a lot watching modern wrestling, is the standing shooter is one of those moves that I think a lot of people pull off and it looks like dirt. Ricochet looked like that he was at stand, he ran and jumped and did it, and his rotation was so high that, like, he came down like 3 feet in the air down on Mochizuki on this standing shooting star press, and it just was phenomenal. And made you think, like, this is a match with Mochizuki's in his 40s, both Susumu and Shima are in their late 30s, and you have Ricochet, 23 years old, coming in here and proving himself to be a star amongst, like, these three, at least, legends of the Dragon System. They worked really well there. They played up the idea that Shima and Shima was out of Blood Warriors and was trying to get Ricochet kind of out and away and trying to get him over to the side. Chuck Taylor was great on color commentary. Lenny Leonard was tremendous on play-by-play as well, and just was, like, an excellent match. That it was, like, 24 minutes, and it was 24 minutes that, like, brought the house down, and in a venue that really could have gone wrong and went wrong for other promotions, this is the way to have a Dragon Gate USA main event. I went 4.5 stars on this.
I was at 4.75. I think I was just a little bit higher than you on everything on this show. And I don't know, you know, what that speaks to. I don't think there's any massive reason for that. This is a match that I had seen before and a match that I had given the same rating to a few years ago when I saw it for the first time. It's the Dragon System tag match. And if you like that style, like Mike and I do, it's going to be your thing. And if you have any sort of drawbacks or reservations, it's not the match for you. But this hit every single box that I wanted it to hit. And it was just capped off by this incredible finishing sequence between Shima and Susumu after, like I said earlier, after Shima took so much offense in this match, he was able to overcome, he was able to hit the Meteor, and he was able to put Susumu away for the win. Like I said, 4.75, I was all about this.
Yeah, no, this is just, like, one of those matches that, talking about, like, the resets, talking about how this show felt a little different and not necessarily how I was anticipating it, like, it really was, like, you started off this with, like, a WrestleMania show, but then you ended the show with, like, true excellence. And this is the kind of stuff that you want to see out of DGUSA. This is the kind of stuff that I feel like that this is the good stuff. This is what you really want out of this. And it was a perfect capper on a great show that just kind of, it was a show that you, at least in my estimation, was just, like, a complete success to start off the year. And that's not even getting into the oddly delightful post-match stuff.
Yeah, which, by all means, this seems to be your bread and butter, so go ahead.
So, Hulk and Akira attack, Loki makes a save, he starts staring everyone down, and I think it was Lenny who said, oh, we have a new sheriff in town, and now we have Sheriff Loki basically making sure we're all going to be cool here. I am Loki. We're going to make sure everyone here is not acting up here. Everyone's going to be on their best behavior. And it just was like truly like just one of those things. I was like, yeah, Loki, everyone's going to be on their best behavior because you're here. You've got us all on the straight and narrow. I appreciate this from you, Loki. And it just was an absolute just a funny time out of this match. I had and that led right into Loki giving everyone their personal histories, which was, again, him staring down Akira Tozawa the entire time and gets Blood Warriors to back away. And then he goes, Masaki Mochizuki, war, battle arts, you've been everywhere. You do a style I love. And it just was like this. And it's like, Ricochet, you, 2011, you wore a belt reaper. And it's just like one of those weird like things that you hear him say, and you're like, why would you say that ever? Only you would say this,
Loki. You're not going to give him direction. Mike, you've been on films. So that's what you're going to do, direct Loki?
Oh, I would never dream of directing Loki. Like, you let the man cook.
I was talking to someone a few days ago who has worked with Loki in the past, and we were just talking about how good Loki is, and I was like, you know, here's the thing, like, I'm not against publicly shaming people who aren't wearing masks in public, but if I walk by, like, what am I gonna do, tell Loki to wear a mask? Like, who am I? This man will kill me. Like, he's the one guy that gets a pass. Like, whatever, like, look, take care of yourself, take care of others, protect everyone. Loki he'll be fine. He will put the coronavirus into submission, and you will not want to mess with him afterwards.
Yeah, yeah, and that's not even the best thing. Then he talked about Shima. He was like, when you were starting off and you were the star running of things, I was in 0-1. And I was like, do you think Shima was aware of Loki's 0-1 scent? Do you think like anyone nearly even cares? And that's when I decided that Loki was the greatest DGUSA historian, and we can't compare. Because I'm not going to tell him otherwise.
Oh, absolutely.
It just was like,
no.
I mean, it's...
I love it so much just because Ki is the antithesis of everything that Dragon Gate preaches. Like, this co-op, communal, family-style company that isn't overly ambitious, like, just stays in their lane and does their work. Loki is the exact opposite of that, and I love it. I love his dynamic in this promotion.
It's just, like, so bizarre, but it's bizarre in a way that, like, when Bryan Danielson was in this promotion, he was pretty much doing what he wanted to do. But like Bryan Danielson, it's like, I want to have great matches. I want to have like these things, and I'm gonna talk about like what this promotion and by proxy what Gabe Sapolsky means to me. And you have Loki out there. Loki doesn't care about DGUSA, to be honest. He's more excited to talk about battle arts with Masaki Mochizuki and comparing a really wild thing where he's like, when I was a rookie, you're a rookie. It's like, no, Shima debuted like 5 years before the time you're talking about. Shima was already the top star in the Dragon System at that time. But you're not going to tell Loki anything because he's a historian and he's the sheriff. I'm going to refer to him now in this as Sheriff Loki. He's going to get a little star to put on his vest when he comes out here, and it's tremendous stuff. And how can't you like watch this? And unless you're someone that's like either like Loki's a bad person, or you're someone that is like Loki is the most important indie wrestler of all time, and everyone else bow to the wrath of Loki. If you're like the right mindset of like, okay, I just like this insane match, and now Loki's here basically giving a book report. It was this whole he clears the ring and gives a book report.
Look, I'm pumped to have, I think it's two more Dragon Gate USA shows with Loki on it, because I think the promotion's infinitely better with him than without him.
Yeah. Loki will be a featured star through Miami, and I think he's out of here. I'm pretty certain that he's out after Miami, but we get...
No, he doesn't work the Midwest shows in July, so it's just, we have three Loki shows. It's unbelievable how fast the good times go by.
it's like, yeah, because... And then he will not be saying farewell from forever, though, luckily. We will see him again.
Oh, my God. That's
the sheriff.
God, that's right.
Does write again. The sheriff.
Well.
He has other pastures to go take care of first. He has to go make sure everyone else is on the straight and narrow. There's no fighting, and that he can say everything anyone needs to know about certain wrestlers. Like, also, by the way, no comments whatsoever towards Susumu Yokosuka. No comments.
It didn't study. Didn't know what he was talking about. It's his fault.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he didn't do anything that interested him. He did not take belts. He was not in battle arts. I mean, you could talk about how he was someone that did Michinoku Pro training, Loki. Like, you're only going to get a B on this book report from me. You did not complete the brief.
I will pose this question to you.
Okay.
Now that I believe we've wrapped up what it was an eventful post-match promo and a show that I love top to bottom. We've gone through 2.5 years, really, of Dragon Gate USA shows. Is Open the Golden Gate to this point the best Dragon Gate USA show there's ever been?
You know, when I was like looking through everything to get together my rankings, I liked the show top to bottom more than anything else in 2011. I don't think I like it as much as Open the Untouchable Gate.
That is the exact one that I don't think it's better than, but I think right now this is the second best show we've seen.
And it's wild because this is a spot show. They literally did this show because they could fly out there and then fly back to Japan and pick up all the Americans on the way.
Yeah, but it worked. I mean, it was, you know, it's almost one of those things. I wonder if this was a more efficient way of doing things than the double or even triple shots, because everybody had the one match, they worked super hard, and they went home. And that's what Dragon Gate USA should have been.
I mean, hey, I will take it. I will take it. So, it was a great show. You know, is something that's completely kind of broken my brain in a little bit of a way, but in the right way. Like, now I'm imagining Sheriff Aluki, like, appearing at the Collective and going, like, Paradigm Pro Wrestling, I see that you do UWFI rules matches. I find those matches interesting, too. And, I mean, he's the person who quit out of doing the first ever Bloodsport. Remember that 2 years ago?
Oh, I do, because everybody was pissed at him. I was like, you know what?
It's Loki.
Good for Loki. I was like, yeah, good for him. He doesn't need to do this. He doesn't need to work Matt Riddle. Fuck that. No, protect your image.
Matt Riddle's beneath Loki. He does not have a good enough brief for him to talk about.
In a way, Loki was on the right side of history, because I wouldn't want to waste my time with Matt Riddle either. But it is, you know, one of those things. I mean, this episode will come out after the Collective has happened. I hope Loki goes to the Collective and double stomps every single dork there. I think that would be an efficient use of time.
Loki versus the Karate Man, Ethan Page. Just takes his head off.
God. God, what a waste of talent Ethan Page is. Mike, is there anything else on Open the Golden Gate that you need to discuss? Or are we ready to break down what's coming next week?
I mean, I kind of want to do low-key book reports and everyone else, but that might be content that will make this show extremely long, and everyone will be like, okay, Spears, we get it. You find low-key very funny. So, yes, let's break down Heat.
That's paywall content, my friend. But as for Heat, which is coming up next week, we are going to WrestleMania weekend in Hollywood, Florida, for a show that will feature... Oh, Loki's on this show, so we've got three low-key shows. That's terrific.
The sheriff is in Florida. The sheriff's in Florida, Case.
It's Loki versus Bobby Fish, Ricochet versus Mike Cruz, who I will be giving a book report on next week, Masato Yoshino versus a debuting luchador who will remain nameless until we start that show, the Scene of Caleb Conley and Scott Reed are going to wrestle Shima and Masaki Mochizuki, Pac will wrestle AR Fox, and the main event, we get the signature Dragon Gate match coming to America, the 9-man tag team 3-way elimination match with Ronan, the DUF, and Mad Blanky of Akira Tozawa, BB Hulk, and Uha Nation.
Boy, things are changing and changing quick. We will have a lot of stuff to talk about before we even get into this match. And I have a story about the show as well that we'll get into, as we will be fully into Spears territory for the next few weeks.
I look forward to it. Should be a lot of fun shows, and I am very happy with Dragon Gate USA in 2012 up to this point.
We might be in an era of good feelings. We'll see how long this lasts. Probably not long.
Not long. No, not at all.
Yeah, so that's going to do it for this episode of Open the Voice Gate Rewind and Rewatch. We'll be back with you next week as we head to Miami for 2012 WrestleMania season. Take care, everyone.